I'm Christopher Lighton. This is The Whole Wide World, looking this hour at the ecological burden of putting 3 squares a day on a few billion tables around the world.
$2.
My man, what are we getting for the blackberries?
$1 on all the berries.
Almost any kind of food shopping these days puts you into a world market, not only for exotic plantains or mangoes, but also for what we used to think of as local produce.
And where the plums come?
They were from Chile.
Half the table grapes we Americans eat were grown abroad, 60% of the asparagus, 1/3 of our fresh tomatoes. This gloriously tasty abundance and diversity of our food markets didn't happen by accident. Over the last half century, a concerted strategy in food technology and trade has eased the world past what was said to be an unsustainable population explosion. There are still hungry people, but there's more food than ever, thanks to a web of innovations in irrigation, in hybrid seeds, in specialization, and fertilization, known collectively as the Green Revolution. The alternative to that revolution was mass starvation, as most of us understand our history. So it's not surprising that there's a huge institutional momentum for sticking to that strategic path. Kevin Cleaver is the top farm and food specialist at the World Bank in Washington. The big trend line in his career has been that rising curve of food production. Globalization of farming methods and markets has been overwhelmingly good news, he'd tell you, not just for shoppers and eaters, but for enterprising farmers the world over. Kevin Cleaver has watched and celebrated the example of Kenyan farmers in East Africa.
The market is here. We are already globalized. I lived in Kenya working on agriculture there, and the Kenyans both imported and exported, and they liked it just like that. What did they export? They exported tea and coffee, a little bit of cotton, cut flowers, vegetables to Europe. And in fact, what did they make a lot of money on? They made a lot of money on flowers, which they could produce in the European winter. So they would put them on an airplane and send them to Hamburg. And the farmers that were producing those things generated so much income. They were able to buy so much more food than they would have had they just produced their own food crop. So globalization actually helps most farmers.
There's nothing wrong with globalization, Kevin Cleaver would argue, that couldn't be fixed by further globalization in the form of lower tariffs on food imports to markets like the United States and a wider, heavier traffic in trade.
Our own civilization is based on trade. We, you know, Adam Smith told us about this before. I trade with you. If you do something better than I and I do something better than you, we exchange the product of that trade. And this is exactly what the Kenyans discovered. They could make a lot more money by producing these cut flowers and vegetables and exporting it to Europe. Many, many, many times more money than just scratching the soil for just enough corn and sukumawiki to keep them alive. The world itself has a food surplus. There's more production per capita in the world than there ever was before, even with a bigger population. The world food prices on world markets are declined. So those Kenyans can go right to the market and buy it. Absolutely no problem. Why should we? You know, you and I don't produce everything that we consume. You and I don't produce the cars, the computer chips. We can't. We look for specialists to do that. So what is wrong with African farmers doing the same thing, producing those things that generate the highest income, which they trade for those things that they need, the foodstuffs that they need on the world market that are relatively cheap. That's what they're doing. And the question, therefore, is to find those activities that would generate them the most income. This gets to the biggest problem of the global agricultural market, which is that most farmers do not have the access to markets that those lucky Kenyan farmers do because they happen to produce a niche product that the Europeans and the Americans can't produce, which is flowers in the wintertime. Do we want to condemn African farmers to subsistence, to producing just enough to feed themselves? Do they not have the right to generate a surplus to purchase clothes and shoes and schools and health facilities? You know, what is conceivably wrong with this?
Kevin Cleaver, meet Vandana Shiva.
I personally feel outraged as a scientist at the lies told in the name of feeding the hungry.
Author, activist, and physicist Vandana Shiva is in the thick of the global food fight, leading third world peasant farmers against the industrial food system in its many forms, the farm chemicals, the subsidized exports, the monocultures in the field and on the plate. Vandana Shiva is at war with the myth, as she calls it, of progress in food production. Her anti-global banner is local varieties, local values, local taste. Vandana Shiva, I wish you'd take it very small, to the level of, the Indian village farmer. How has globalization changed, and you would say impoverished, his world and his work?
Over the last decade, as the impacts of globalization have unfolded in India, I have traveled to villages in Punjab, which was one of the most prosperous farming areas, where village after village is like a permanent mourning, because farmers who could not just make a living but did it well are today in such deep debt that they can't pay back, and they are committing suicide. Down in Andhra Pradesh, another area which has had an epidemic of farm suicides, our calculation is more than 20, 30,000 farmers have consumed the same pesticides that got them into debt. The cycle for that small farmer, for example, in a very semi-arid village in the Deccan Plateau of India, the transition under globalization has meant giving up growing the 15 to 20 crops he or she grew in order to feed themselves and sell something on the marketplace. It would involve millets, it would involve legumes, it would involve chilies or some vegetables, 80% of which would be consumed by the family, none of which required irrigation. It was rain-fed farming, dryland farming. And what you had, even in dry areas, food self-sufficiency. And then in the 80s, using the so-called freedom of globalization, companies like Monsanto started to move in very, very rapidly with new hybrid cotton seeds, promising farmers they were going to become millionaires, using every one of our gods and goddesses to be their marketing agents, bringing videos that made it look like every American farmer who's driving a car has become rich because they bought white gold or some global seed. The cost of production shot up to more than 100,000 rupees an acre. What they're earning by selling their cotton or their groundnut or their soybean is going down.
It's a pretty grim overview. I wonder, is there any good news here, as you see it, in globalization?
In the area of food, unfortunately, the news is all bad.
Wow.
Because food is best produced when you take care of ecosystem limits, when food cultures evolve out of the biodiversity of the region, and that is why in a country like India, every region has a different cuisine. You go to the south and they cook their food in coconut oil because that's the oil seed of that region. You come to the north, we cook our food in mustard oil because that's the oil seed of our region. And since 1998, both the coconut oil economy and the groundnut oil economy and the sesame nut economy and the mustard oil economy have been destroyed by the forced dumping of genetically engineered soy oil on Indian markets, wiping out our local consumption. Food is the kind of thing in which a few things should be globally traded, but they should be produced under the sensibilities of local limits.
Have we not all accepted that under the old ecosystem limits, we couldn't feed a billion Indians or 6.5 billion people on the earth?
In fact, it is only under ecosystem limits that you can actually feed people. For example, the Green Revolution, which is the name given to industrial agriculture when it was imposed on third world countries, and in my view, it was neither green nor very revolutionary, it led to 5 to 10 times more water used to produce the same amount of nutrition. Per unit land, we produced less nutrition. We produced higher monocultures and used more chemicals. But overall, the food basket did not increase.
Let's be simple-minded here. Is there not less starvation and hunger today than there was 30, 40 years ago?
That's not at all true.
Okay.
The case of India is a case that is my life. It is my history.
Let's talk about it.
1942 was the last big famine that hit India, and it was the result of free trade policies of that time in which the British were extracting all the food produced, using it to feed the armies for that big war, that the last big war we had, while the producers of food were not being left with enough to eat, the 2 million people who were pushed to starvation died in spite of enough food being available. Hunger and starvation disappeared from India after our independence in 1947. The Green Revolution only came in 1966. No one died of hunger in India in between, before the technological intervention of pushing chemicals and what I call weapons of mass destruction as a basis of food production. That's when the Green Revolution was imposed on us. It did not increase the overall food basket. It did start shifting the bias towards what I have called monocultures of the mind.
That phrase, monocultures of the mind, echoes Michael Pollan's monocultures of taste and that risky monoculture of potatoes. But notice also that Vandana Shiva refers to the Green Revolution not as a gift, but an imposition. We heard Kevin Cleaver of the World Bank promoting specialty crops for export. His example was Kenyan flowers for Europe. Vandana Shiva's counterexample is hybrid cotton in India. These are ventures where Vandana Shiva says India goes deep into debt to pay for its poison.
The large dams, irrigation systems, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, new research stations that deployed it all, making us forget 10,000 years of good farming knowledge. All this was made possible by the loans that the World Bank literally imposed on us. Interestingly, in the first round, the World Bank and IMF give you what they call soft loans. So it looks to third world countries, well, this is not going to cost us too much. And then when they've got you hooked onto a non-sustainable path and got you hooked into what in agriculture has amounted to getting farmers and countries addicted to what has been called ecological narcotics, where the more you use pesticides, the more you need them. The more you use chemical fertilizers, the more you have to apply them. The more you use water, the more you need it. All of this creates an addiction of an ecological kind. All of this is wonderful for the World Bank, which then moves its loans to the high interest bracket, as a result of which, by 1991, one-third of India's debt, at that time of $90 billion, was really loans, unnecessary loans, taken for poisons for farming and destroying our farmlands and forests and biodiversity and uprooting our indigenous communities to build large irrigation systems.
Genetically modified and patented seeds are yet another intrusion that Vandana Shiva fights tooth and nail. Americans generally don't know what to make of this picture of poor countries batting away the helping hand of science and food relief.
I can at best give you the example of India to tell you what it means. In 1998, when our Indian edible oil economy was shattered because of globalization, and our mustard oil, particularly the most popular cooking oil of North India, was banned, and free imports of soya were allowed, on the same day the two things happened. And the women of the slums of Delhi called me to say, we need our mustard oil. And the women said, we are going to dump the soya. We are going to come out and have an action. Will you join us? I said, of course I'll join you. I then did the studies.
But what are they fighting here?
They're fighting. Basically, the women said, our children are not going to sleep because the taste of soya they can't stand. They love the taste of mustard. Food, we must not forget, food is us. Food makes us. The aromas, the taste, the cultures, the cultural quality of food is so intimately a part of what we are as our biological beings, the human body. For you to just change food overnight and say, stop eating mustard oil, eat soya oil, can be traumatic. The poorest of women, the poorest of children, were the ones making a choice and saying, we will boycott soya, we want our mustard back. And they did that, and we had to have huge pressure, but mustard was allowed to come back to the marketplace after a year of direct action by the women.
The chance to grow flowers in Kenya for winter markets in northern Europe makes globalism sound irresistible. On the other hand, the loss of sovereignty over seeds and the very savor of traditional food can be causes worth fighting for. When we come back, water, global warming, and other weak links in the environmental food chain. This is the Whole Wide World from PRI, Public Radio International.